Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580 in truly beautiful Urbana, Illinois, this Sunday afternoon, April 9th, 2006. Today we have a wonderful show, long anticipated. There is certainly a major change, perhaps even a revolution going on in media, in political journalism, and maybe even in politics in the United States today. And we have perhaps the ideal guest to discuss this with us on Media Matters today. Marcos Melitzis is our guest today, the founder and head of the Daily Coast website, known to many of our listeners, dailycoast.com. Marcos Melitzis served in the U.S. Army for 3 years and later earned 2 degrees from Northern Illinois University and a law degree from Boston University. After moving to California, he started dailycoast.com in May 2002. It has had nothing short of an extraordinary meteoric rise and now gets over 1 million unique visitors each day, making it, I think, number one or number two in internet traffic for all sites overall or all political sites, certainly. Marcos lives in Berkeley, California. Marcos, welcome to Media Matters.
Love to be here. Thanks so much.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. And I know you're out right now promoting your brand new book, and I want to make sure our listeners are familiar with it, Crashing the Gate, Netroots, Grassroots, and the Rise of People-Powered Politics, which you co-authored with Jerome Armstrong. And this book, I think, having read it, safe to say, it's a lot about the web, and it's a lot about the blog and your website and mydd.com, Jerome Armstrong's website. But it's also really about politics, and it's about changing the nature of U.S. politics. Is that a fair assessment?
Absolutely. When we started writing this book, a lot of people wanted us to write the book about blogs. And to us, blogging really is just a medium. What we really write about is politics. That's what we talk about. That's what we really care about. So we wanted this book to be about politics. And yes, blogging has a new role in the Democratic Party politics of the future, but it's only a role. There's a lot more happening.
Well, talk about what function you see blogging, specifically liberal blogging. And later on, I'd like to talk a little bit about the conservative Republican bloggers as well. But specifically, when you started dailycoast.com some 4 years ago now, what was the vision you had then, or how's the vision evolved, and what role do you see liberal blogging playing in the political process today?
Well, when I started the blog in 2002, this was a nascent medium. There were a lot of blogs, but nobody really had any traffic. The highest traffic blogs at the time had maybe a couple hundred visitors a day. So it was never something that people started thinking it was going to be a path to influence and fame and riches and anything like that. So I started blogging because I had a lot to say, and it didn't matter if I was the only person reading it or if maybe my friends and my family read it. What mattered is that I wanted to have a voice in an environment at the time, 2002, when there were absolutely no liberal voices and partisan liberal voices in the media. It was very bleak. This is at the end of the Afghanistan war, run up to the Iraq war. So if you criticized the president on any issue, domestic or foreign, you were considered to be seditious because you didn't criticize the president during war. So it was in that kind of stifling environment that the site started. And what really happened, which was really incredible, is that there was a real market need for partisan liberal voices in the media landscape. They did not exist, so blogs like mine and others really, really grew quickly because people really were desperate for this sort of information, this sort of news, and this sort of voice, and we ended up providing that.
Now, when I turn on Fox News and watch Bill O'Reilly or even watch what are considered more mainstream commentators like Chris Matthews, they will say, hey, the New York Times and the Washington Post and NPR, these are the rabidly liberal media. What are you talking about, Coz?
Well, the conservatives have a real problem with reality because it so often conflicts with their ideology. And so anything that talks about reality, such as bombings in Iraq or evolution or global warming, is somehow liberal, when in fact it's just facts. There's things that are true and things that are not true that are not open to interpretation, and those are very many of those. But beyond that, there is no partisan liberal media. I mean, I make that very clear, partisan. There is a conservative partisan machine that basically gets its talking orders and works hand-in-hand with the conservative movement and the Republican Party. We're talking to Fox News, Rush Limbaugh, pretty much almost the entire AM radio, and the Washington Times, and the Wall Street Journal editorial page, and freerepublic.com, and on and on and on. And these are very partisan and working hand in hand to promote the conservative agenda. There is nothing like that on the left, and it's just now very nascently emerging with the blogs, and also with some liberal radio, partisan liberal radio like Air America, but it's very, very tiny compared to what they have on the right.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Marcos Moulitsas, the founder, and I don't know what your position is, head of Daily...
Blogger.
Head blogger, blogger-in-chief for DailyCoast.com, the website that is at DailyCoast.com. And you have, what, is a million unique visitors a day, is that right?
It's between 600,000 and a million. We're in a kind of a little pre-election lull right now, but it's starting to pick up again. By election time this year, by November, I'm expecting about 2 to 3 million visitors a day. So it just peaks and valleys, and right now we're in a kind of a valley.
Now, I just want to ask you a few technical questions about blogs that interest me, and I think a lot of our listeners are interested in, but I want to get back to your book, Crashing the Gate, and the political work you're doing, because I think that, as you've made it clear, that really drives what you're doing. But, I mean, you, I assume, can now support yourself more or less from your blog. But if you can't, that says a lot about how difficult it will be for blogs to be self-sustaining. I mean, what is the economics of running a blog like, if you're doing a political blog like DailyCoast.com?
Once you get a fair amount of traffic, it's advertising is can support a blogger. I'm doing very well advertising wise, and so I live fairly comfortably, and it is my full-time job. There are maybe, you know, I would say maybe 20 bloggers that maybe do this full-time that can actually afford to blog full-time.
And do you think we're pretty much at the upward limit of how many bloggers can support themselves generating money, largely, I guess, almost exclusively through advertising or some sort of sales operation to support them? Or is there room for hundreds more? What do you think?
Oh, there's plenty of room. I mean, right now, just a fraction of the American public actually read blogs. And, you know, I'm not talking just political blogs. I mean, right now, the fastest growing segment in the blog world are the entertainment blogs, very snarky entertainment blogs, and they're doing absolutely fabulous. And most of those bloggers are going to be pretty much full-time anytime soon. Sports blogging has just really begun. It's just now starting to catch on. So there's going to be many sports bloggers that are going to be able to do that full-time. So I absolutely think that there's going to be eventually, within maybe even just as soon as 2-3 years, we're going to have thousands of bloggers that can do this full-time.
And it's sort of anyone can dive in and start it and see what happens?
Absolutely. I mean, the tools for blogging are really, you can essentially get them for free. You can blog for free. It takes time, and it's so addictive that I think a lot of people lose sight of just how much time it takes. But no, absolutely, anybody can start it. And, you know, not everybody's going to be mega successful. It's like anything else, right? There's people who have the right voice and have the right tone and connect with an audience, and it can grow that audience, and other people have less luck. So, but there's definitely a lot of room for new emerging voices. And that's what's so exciting, I think, about the blog world to me, is that it's still in such flux that somebody who's popular today in 9 months may be off the map, but people who were nobody 9 months ago now are fairly popular. So there is nothing assured, not even me and Daily Coast. I mean, it's all in flux.
You know, Marcos Moulitsas, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. I go to your website. I'm one of the 600,000 daily unique visitors. And I see a series of regular contributors that are on sort of your homepage there. Do you have a staff? Or are these volunteers? Who writes for you? Who gets featured? Do you have paid people? How does that operate?
I have one staffer, and he's a programmer. That's the only person I actually pay. I also have contractor programmers that are working on the site. They're not on staff; they're on contract basis. The writers, though, there's a function on Daily Coast called the diaries, where anybody can essentially have a blog within the Daily Coast blog. And some of these writers develop quite a following of their own and become quite popular. And every year, what I do is I pick 4 new people that become contributing editors on the site, and they can post on the front page of the site. So. It's constantly moving, so I like to treat it as a farm system to give some of these best voices, most popular voices on Daily Coast, an even bigger platform for their writings. And a lot of these have alumni have gone on and started their own very successful blogs, so I actually enjoy doing that. It's volunteer for them, and I wish I could pay, but I'm not quite at that point. I'm at the point where I can pay for myself and I can pay for a programmer, but paid staff is still a little bit ways off, I think.
Our guest today in Media Matters is Marcos Milicis Zuniga, the founder of DailyCos.com website, the largest, I think, political website or blog in the world.
Yeah, by far.
By far. And the author, along with Jerome Armstrong, of the brand new book, Crashing the Gate, Netroots, Grassroots, and the Rise of People Power Politics, which is just storming up the charts, as far as I can tell, and has a foreword by Simon Rosenberg, a prominent Democratic Party official. And I'd like to talk a lot about this book because, as you said at the outset, Marcos, this book really deals with the politics that drove you to do the DailyCos.com and that drives the work you're doing and a lot of bloggers. What is your critique of the Democratic Party? And you are explicitly a Democrat. There's no one's going to read this book wondering what your political views are.
I'm absolutely a partisan. But I'm also that's one of the reasons we wrote the book. I'm such a partisan Democrat that I got tired of seeing the Democratic Party lose election after election after election. It was frustrating. In 2004, if you went up and down the list of issues like Social Security and the environment and education and things like that, Democrats had huge leads over Republicans and George Bush. If you asked Americans if they thought the country was going in the right direction or the wrong direction, people were overwhelmingly stating wrong direction. If you asked people if they approved of George Bush, even in 2004, his approval ratings were already coming down. They were in the low 50s, high 40s. So when you look at all of that and you still lose that election, you have to think there's something fundamentally wrong with the way the Democratic Party does business. You cannot be ahead on almost every single issue. You cannot be against a unpopular president, and lose unless there are some structural, fundamental problems with the way you do business. And that's what really drove us to write this book, is to find out why we lost that election and what we could do to fix it.
And why did we lose it, and what can we do to fix it then?
Well, what we have is a very antiquated Democratic Party. You have people who had great successes in the 60s and 70s, times of great progressive advancement in things like the environment and women's rights and workers' rights, and suddenly the world changed. The world evolved. Instead of having four channels on television, now you have 500. You have the Internet. You have a Republican Party that realized that it was going to stay in the minority. It's not a very popular party. Its positions are not very popular. To win, it had to do something more. And what it did is it built this incredible, vast right-wing conspiracy. And, you know, we say it's not even a conspiracy. It's out in the open. They're not hiding it. What they do is they spend hundreds of millions of dollars every year building a network of think tanks, of leadership institutes, of media machines like Fox News. And they have a very modernized party machinery and consultant class of Karl Rove. On our side, we're still pretending it's the 1970s. We have not evolved. So obviously we're up against this machine. When we're up against the latest and greatest technologies and strategies, we actually don't really stand much of a chance. And to us, what was really surprising is that we're as competitive as we are, given how huge their advantage is from an infrastructure standpoint.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Marcos Milicis, founder of DailyCos.com and co-author of the brand new book, Crashing the Gate, Netroots, Grassroots, and the Rise of People-Powered Politics. If you'd like to call in to Media Matters today, our phone lines are open at 333-9455 or our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. In the next 2 weeks here on Media Matters, our guests are going to be next week Stanford Law Professor Lawrence Lessig talking about constitutional issues and the future of the Internet and Internet policy. Lessig, arguably the greatest expert in the country on those subjects. And 2 weeks from today, a very privileged week for all of us, we'll have Howard Zinn here, the U.S. historian, taking your questions and discussing the state of the world today. But our guest today, Marcos Milicis, the DailyCos.com, discussing his new book, Crashing the Gate. And Marcos, as we look at the Democratic Party, you, I think, probably are familiar with Molly Ivan's critique, which is she's quite critical of the Democrats. And I think she's sympathetic on all the issues you talk about and agrees with you and agrees that the bulk of Democratic voters are quite progressive, but sees the leadership of the party as being almost entirely bankrupt. And she wrote a piece to that effect a month or so back, and it's been one of the dominant hits on the Internet since then. What do you think of her critique of the Democratic Party?
Well, they're clearly is a leadership void in the Democratic Party. There's no doubt about that. And when we first started writing this book, you know, our book was going to be about that lack of leadership, you know, about that lack of a cohesive message. And what we found is that really we couldn't even get to that point. We could have the most incredible leaders. We could have the best message, and it would not matter given how dramatic the disadvantages we have from an infrastructure standpoint are. For example, the right wing, when they develop their message, when they develop a policy, they run it through their think tanks. Then they massage the messaging. They pull the words so they can find a way to sell it to the American people. Then they market it via their message machine. You know, it goes on Fox News and Rush Limbaugh. They talk about it, and they can reach 20, 30 million people every week with that message. And remember, this is a partisan conservative, so they're working in concert to promote these policies and messages. And then they have this very effective consultant class and party machinery to actually make the sale on election day. We don't have any of those, so we can have the best message, and it's hard for us to get it out. We can reach maybe 2-3 million people a week via our partisan media outlets, the bloggers and you know, liberal talk radio. But it reaches a much smaller audience. It's harder to push that into kind of the mainstream of America. So I sympathize with the calls for leadership. I agree with them. I am very much convinced that Democrats are not going to make the huge gains that are predicted in November unless they start becoming more clear about their distinctions between Republicans and Democrats. But all in all, at the end of the day, that's almost a short-term problem. I think the long-term problem is still the infrastructure.
And the infrastructure, as you've made it clear, is partially bloggers and what's done on the web, like the dailycoast.com. But it sounds like you're of a school that there also needs to be extraordinarily extraordinary resources devoted to think tanks and conventional media and news gathering. Or explain, if you would, what you have in mind.
Yeah, the blogs really, at the end of the day, only reach the most committed of activists, and they have a huge role in that, in educating and motivating the core party activists. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, that's not going to win elections. You know, we're not going to win elections by talking to supporters. We need to reach out to broader America. And the way we need to do that is by having the media institutions and television and radio and creating more online, too. And we also need the idea factories to generate our message and to massage it and convert it into a governing blueprint. And then we obviously need a party and a consultant class that is effective at closing the sale on election day. I've seen the last two cycles, Democrats had advantages over Republicans going into the final weeks of the election, but Republicans can close the deal like nobody's business. That's why when I look at these polls right now showing Democrats far ahead of Republicans, I shake my head and I say, well, that's wonderful, but the election is until November, and they will close the deal.
Before we go to the phone lines, Marcus, I do want to just continue on the Molly Ivins critique, because it really is something that I've seen printed elsewhere and a lot of people have written about, which is that there's a disconnect between the rank-and-file voters of the Democratic Party, like yourself, and the people who read Daily Coast, and the leadership, not because the leadership are just bad people or anything, but the money that supports the Democratic Party comes from oftentimes, self-interested parties that limits the ability of the leadership to do the right thing on issues like bankruptcy and health care and other issues right on down the line. Do you think that's a serious issue, or is that solvable?
Well, it is a serious issue, and it is solvable, but it's a long-term solution. Everything we talk about in the book is a long-term solution, which sort of frustrates a lot of people because they want instant gratification, but we don't have this here. Republicans spent 30 years building their machine. It's going to take us at least a decade to build ours. Now, that argument, I definitely agree. And one of the problems the Democratic Party has had in the last couple of decades is that it was addicted to the large soft dollar donation, the million-dollar-plus donations. Republicans have always had a very large, huge, small donor pool.
And a large donor pool.
Large pool of small-dollar donors.
Yeah.
And what that forces them to do is be more responsive to the rank and file, because that's where the bulk of their money comes from. People think that, well, the Democrats are the party of the people, and from an ideological standpoint, we are. But from a practical standpoint, they have been much better at creating that large pool of donors. We have always been, Democrats have always gotten their money from these big dollar donors. So they've never really had to worry about being responsive to their base, to their core activists, to their supporters. Now that's changing. Campaign finance reform limited the number of big dollar donations to the parties. Not limited, eliminated them. And so they have to go, they have to build that pool of small dollar donors. And as that becomes more and more ingrained in the party, they're going to have to become more and more responsive to that. And I think that's a long-term solution. And I think we're moving in that direction. And it's going to take a few years, if not, you know, 10 years, for the party to be retrained to think in this new fashion, because they're not used to it. And they have to be, a lot of times they have to be, you know, we have to beat them over the head to remind them who is now in charge of the party. And it is the rank and file of the Democratic Party.
My name is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. We're coming to you live today, April 9th, 2006. Our guest today is Marcos Mulitzis Zuniga, the author or co-author, along with Drone Armstrong, of the brand new book, Crashing the Gate, Netroots, Grassroots, and the Rise of People Power Politics. Marcos, our guest, also known as Coase, is probably best known as the founder, head blogger-in-chief of thedailycoase.com, the wildly popular website devoted to advancing Democratic and liberal politics. Our phone line here at Media Matters is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line one, thank you for your patience. You're on with Coase.
Oh, thank you. I am so excited about reading your new book. I have a couple questions. Do you think we were on the right track? I noticed that John Dean really was trying to use some of the new types of media, and they're still connecting with people who are very interested in using the technology to organize. But I did see, you know, it was a horror to me to see people voting against their own interests. And how do you think we can form those kinds of points? I mean, like you said, lockstep. The conservative ethos was almost like they got a mimeograph machine and got it out to even all of the churches and things like that. So what can we do? I know you say we need think tanks, but there are people like Bill Press out there and Jim Wallace and all of these wonderful thinkers. They're very accessible if people would just know about them. I'm really coming at it from a liberal Christian point of view, and I'll hang up and hear what you have to say.
Well, thank you very much. And, Coase, when you answer that, if you could talk a little bit about the Howard Dean campaign, because I think that is sort of the case study that's often used for the ability of the net to mobilize people.
Absolutely. The Dean campaign used technologies in ways that obviously had never been used before. They used the technology, they used blogging and other tools to connect people from disparate parts of the country in a shared common interest. One of the reasons it took conservatives so long to build is because it was difficult for them to connect people. They had to do it the old-fashioned way with snail mail and things like that. Now we have the ability to speed up that process by using these technologies to connect people. And when people get together and work together in concert, obviously they can accomplish incredible things, such as turning the long-shot, obscure governor of a New England state into the front runner of a Democratic Party primary. So what we couldn't do, and we never will be able to do, is essentially reach undecided voters, reach just people who are just peripherally interested in politics. That's why we need the people who are being connected, these activists, to actually turn off the computer and hit the roads. One of the things that Republicans did in Ohio very, very effectively in 2004 is they had a sort of Amway pyramid scheme thing where every activist had to reach 10 people and get those 10 people to the polls. And they try to get each of those 10 people to then go out and do another 10 people. So it increased this kind of pyramid scheme web thing, getting more and more people activated and turning out in behalf of the Republicans. I think that's a brilliant move, and it's something that we all need to do if we are Democrats and want the party to win. We need to convince 10 people that we know, and I think we all know 10 people who don't vote. We need to get them to the polls. If we have to drive them themselves, drag them to the polls, we need to do that and get as many of those people to commit to also getting 10 more people to the polls. I mean, it's a very simple concept and very low-tech in a lot of ways, but it worked. It worked for Bush in 2004. And the technology allows us to organize and work together and get talking points, figure out ways to reach these people who don't want to vote or are voting Republican, and do that sort of organizing. But at the end of the day, the things that are actually going to win elections are the low-tech, getting out and getting our friends and families and social circle to get out and vote.
Now, I notice on your website there are a handful of candidates whose prospects you're touting in the Democratic Party, either in primaries or in the upcoming general elections. What is your take on the prospects for the Democrats? You've already referred to it briefly, but, I mean, what's your sense of how things will go this November?
What I'm seeing, and I've been traveling the country almost nonstop the last 6 months, what I've been seeing is that people are obviously disgusted with the Bush administration, and we see that reflected in the opinion polls. Very, very negative. And so there isn't a lot of enthusiasm for the Republican Party. Now, Democrats in D.C. are seeing that, and they think that means that people are still going to turn out and vote Democratic as a response to that. What I'm seeing, actually, is that Democrats are really not motivated. They've been burned for three elections in a row. They had their hopes raised and crushed by the Democrats the last three cycles. And they look at these Democrats in D.C., and they're saying they still talk the same. They still sound the same. They're still acting the same way. They're not showing any backbone. They're not showing any sign that they're learning from their mistakes and will change. So if they don't want to change, we're going to lose probably again. So why should I even bother getting up and voting? I'm seeing that, and it's very, very scary.
What would that mean specifically? Does that mean coming out more strongly against the war in Iraq, coming out for Bush's impeachment or censure? What does it mean other than just some sort of, you know, Madison Avenue sort of makeover?
Right. I mean, what I'm, you know, a perfect example is the Russ Feingold censure resolution.
Mm-hmm.
He calls for a resolution, and he botched the rollout. He did not inform his colleagues. So there are some procedural mistakes that I think Russ Feingold made. But getting beyond that, there is a sense that people are running away from him. Nancy Pelosi was quoted saying, why is Russ trying to stir things up right now when Republicans are doing such a good job of screwing things up? And so there's this notion that if we just stay quiet and we don't really talk about things and just let the Republicans screw things up, we're going to be the natural beneficiary.
It's sort of a rope-a-dope defense.
And like I said, I mean, I don't think anybody's going to vote for Republicans. Obviously, not anybody. But I think the Republican turnout will be low. But I think Democratic turnout will be also low. And like I said, Republicans can close like nobody's business. You're going to see the last few weeks of the election, Congress is going to start trying to pass flag-burning amendments, and they're going to try to start attacking gays again, and they're going to rail against those brown people coming over the southern border, and they're going to do all the things they need to do to make sure that their voters turn out and vote, and Democrats are not talking to their base, they're not motivating us to actually do the same. And early primaries, I mean, Democratic turnout has been absolutely abysmal, and this is really scaring me because we should, by all rights, be making absolutely massive gains in November.
Who are the figures in the Democratic Party, the elected officials right now, especially at the national level, who get you excited, who you think really have something on the ball, and who should be the leaders in the party?
You know, that question shouldn't stump me, really.
And no, I know. That's a scary thought.
I think a symptom of the problems we're having. Howard Dean is doing what he needs to do. Howard Dean's absolutely doing a fantastic job of raising money in the states for the states and moving towards a 50-state strategy where the Democratic Party truly is national and not just focus on a couple of swing states. So that's absolutely phenomenal. I think Harry Reid in the Senate, running the Senate Democrats, has done a fair job given the challenges of being such a drastic minority in that chamber. He's done a fairly good job of giving fits to the Republicans and making sure that Democrats are at least seen as having some kind of spine in the Senate. Beyond that, it gets very difficult. Now I can go to the states and I can point to people in the states, Democrats in the states, that are absolutely phenomenal. But when you're looking at the national leadership, it doesn't get much better than that.
Do you see any prospective candidates for the presidential nomination in 2008 to get you fired up?
No, I there's some that have me intrigued. Mm-hmm. I'm intrigued by Russ Feingold. I'm intrigued by Governor Mark Warner of Virginia, and the rest of the field. You know, I'm willing to give all of them a chance, I think it's a little bit way too early right now to really assess their strengths and weaknesses, because we don't know how the country is going to evolve the next 2 years. But right now it's a little early. But like I said, I'm intrigued more so by Feingold and Warner than I am by anybody else in the current prospective field.
Our guest today in Media Matters, Marcos Mulitzes-Zuniga, Daily Coast founder, dailycoast.com, the leading political website, blog in the world, and the author, the co-author, Jerome Armstrong, of the brand new book, and already shooting up the bestseller list, Crashing the Gate, Netroots, Grassroots, and the Rise of People Power Politics. He's our guest today on Media Matters. The phone number here, if you'd like to call in with a question or comment, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We have lines open. And let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 1, Western Springs, you're on with Marcus.
Hello. You talked about Democrats being so aligned with big votes rather than ordinary constituents. Public funding of campaigns has worked well over three election cycles in Maine and Arizona. It enables ordinary people to be competitive without being backed by big money. It connects politicians to their ordinary constituents, and it costs a fraction of the subsidies, tax breaks, and bloated contracts that go to big donors. Public funding of campaigns is pro-democracy and anti-corruption, and it's waiting to happen.
All right. Well, thank you very much, caller. Sounds like you got something for your blog there.
That was an excellent summary of the benefits of public financing of campaigns. I don't think I have anything to add to that.
Yeah, and they do have them now in Maine and Arizona. To your knowledge, are these effective at the local level?
It seems to be. I've been very closely monitoring the Arizona version, and so far, it seems to be working very well. And one of the problems we have in politics, and I find this to be a very serious problem, is the lack of what I'm calling regular people, right? We have plenty of lawyers. We have plenty of rich business people. But where are the nurses? Where are the farmers? Where are the blue-collar workers? Where are the, say, software programmers? Let's talk people who actually work for a living, don't live in a world where they can eat at the fanciest restaurants and travel the world without a second thought. You know, people who live paycheck by paycheck. If we had more of those people in Congress, I think we'd have a vastly different world today. Instead, Congress is dominated by the rich and the wealthy and the connected, and that obviously needs to change. Not just in D.C. too, but also in state government.
Now, one of the races that your website dailycoast.com has taken up is the case of Joseph Lieberman, the senator, senior senator. Is he senior senator? Because Dawes been there, they've been in forever, both of them.
Yeah.
But Lieberman, who's running for re-election this year, and you've been chronicling the and supporting, if I can say so, a Democratic challenger to him in the primaries. Is that what's the story there?
Joe Lieberman is a Democrat that we believe very strongly has kind of lost his moorings. He's kind of lost the fact that he is a Democrat and sees himself in a lot of ways, I think, and this is all conjecture because I don't think anybody really knows his true motivations, but I think he sees himself as a maverick, and his definition of maverick is criticizing and trashing the Democratic Party every chance he gets. This is somebody that is a regular guest on Fox News. Sean Hannity, the conservative talk show host, has offered to do fundraisers for Joe Lieberman. They love him so much on the right. So he's very much somebody who's become a darling of this country's right wing, provides George Bush with cover on the Iraq War and other issues, and we've decided that Connecticut deserves better, and there's a strong grassroots revolt against Lieberman in Connecticut. I mean, I live in Berkeley. I'm not going to tell Connecticut residents how they're going to vote, but seeing that grassroots revolt against Lieberman and their strong support for his primary challenger, Ned Lamont, I've decided to jump aboard and try to help equalize the playing field as much as possible. Lieberman has more money than God. He's well-connected to the insurance industry, and he had Republican lobbyists do a fundraiser for him a couple of weeks ago. So he's well-connected money-wise, so we're trying to help Ned Lamont as much as we can to equalize the field so that Connecticut Democrats can have a real choice come primary time about what kind of Democrat they want representing them in D.C.
Now, standard money would say Ned Lamont's chances of beating an incumbent senator like Lieberman, who usually wins re-election by vast landslides, would be like roughly the same chance because if you're playing center on the next Olympic basketball team for the United States.
Probably even worse.
I mean, this is really a measure, I think, of Netroots activism, because that's really what a lot of Lamont's chances are based on, aren't they?
Well, in some ways. I think there are limits, and we have to acknowledge the limits of the stuff, the Netroots type of activism. We can help raise some money. We can help generate volunteers, and we can help generate media attention. And we're already doing that for Ned Lamont. I think we've effectively shown what we're doing to the point that Joe Lieberman is absolutely freaking out about his reelection chances. We're making him sweat. which, given his position in the polls and all that, that's actually quite surprising to me. And so we can only do so much. At the end of the day, the race is going to be won and lost whether Ned Lamont can sell himself to the voters in Connecticut. You know, he's going to have the money. He's going to have the media attention. Can he close the deal? It's very, very hard to beat an incumbent. Almost never happens. And even harder to beat an incumbent in the primary. So this is a long shot of long shots. But what we're saying is that we're not gonna let these Democrats trash the party and give aid and comfort to Republicans anymore without there being repercussions. If Lieberman pulls through, and he probably will, hopefully he will learn a lesson and be less aggressive in his criticisms of the Democratic Party. Otherwise, we're going to primary him again in 6 years.
My name is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters here on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois, April 9th, 2006. Our guest today, Marcos Militza-Zuniga, co-author with Jerome Armstrong of the brand new book, Crashing the Gate, Netroots, Grassroots, and the Rise of People-Powered Politics. Marcos is also probably best known for founding and being blogger-in-chief of thedailycoast.com, the political blogging website which has the most traffic of any political blogging website in the universe, to our knowledge, certainly in this planet of Earth. We have a full bank of phone lines, and I'm going to get to all the callers right now. Let's go first. Line 2, Champaign County, you're on the air with Marcos Militzas.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. One thing, just sort of stylistically or something, I'd like to hear some ironic quotes around your close the deal quip, because I think what people have been talking about for a long time is that the selling of the presidency, you know, we should be talking about real issues and as opposed to, you know, marketing campaigns. So I don't think you'll argue with that, but it's so easy to slip into that kind of thing. I have a favorite quote of mine, which is that if your coalition doesn't include people you're uncomfortable with, it isn't broad enough. So I'm willing to accept a fair amount, and that's from bell hooks, by the way, if you want to attribute it. But so I'm willing to accept a lot from some Democrats. I think clearly Lieberman is beyond the pale on that score. But I was watching. I don't know if you watch the chat shows. I don't know what they do anymore in this world. You know, if all the religious right are at church or something, maybe they watch them on their pods or something. But Kerry was on this morning and was asked a number of questions, and he was asked if he would vote for censure, and he said yes without really making any big deal of it, which I don't know what the bloggers have done subsequently on that. But then he turns around and talks about Iran, and he says that he would take tactical nuclear weapons off the table. I guess there was a story today in the paper about the U.S. is looking at plans, including going up to the use of tactical nuclear weapons against Iran against their nuclear program. What I'm trying to get at is that as long as the Democrats are going to not make some, or at least some Democrats aren't going to make some kind of critique against the propaganding and saber-rattling of the Bush administration, there's going to be a large fraction that are just of us, of me anyway, that are going to be alienated because, you know, you can have an argument about it, but if there's never any, you know, criticism of U.S. military policy in the world, you know, he would go as far as maybe a deep penetrating weapon, but he wouldn't use a tactical nuke. I don't know how it's not as well thought out as our fair elections advocate, which I certainly agree with, and funding. But if you could react to some of that, I don't actually know where you stand on that. But again, you've said that on many and most of the domestic issues and a lot of the other issues, the Democrats always pull ahead, but the security card is the one that gets played. And it seems that you can't finesse it by promising to be smarter, just by being smarter and stronger. I think there needs to be another critique.
Oh, thank you very much, caller. Coase, I suspect you've heard this issue raised a lot, and you write about it on the site.
Yeah, no, absolutely. To me, the Iran stuff is posturing. We don't have the forces capable to really do what they're claiming to do at this point. I think it's all rhetoric and saber rattling. At least I hope so. I keep thinking, you know, this administration really isn't that stupid, and then they surprise me again and again. So I hope that this time I'm right, that they're really not this stupid.
Do you think there might be a wag the dog scenario with Iran, though?
Absolutely. And Democrats should draw the line. And what's really, you know, infuriating to somebody like me is that there have been several, you know, we have John Murtha, who's a very conservative Democrat, one of the biggest hawks, probably the most beloved Democrat in the Pentagon, who has called out for the withdrawal. So Democrats have the political cover they need. Chuck Hagel, a Republican from Nebraska, has called for withdrawal. Several Republicans in Congress, including the guy who did the Freedom Fry nonsense, has reversed himself and now wants a withdrawal. So we have people who want out. There's political cover, yet they're in constant fear of offending somebody. This is the Democratic Party of today, constant fear. And until they become comfortable in what they believe in and unafraid to stand for those issues and for those ideals and those values, we're going to have a hard time winning. And people like this caller are going to be frustrated. And I know the feeling because I myself am as well.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Our guest today again, Marcos Mulitzes Zuniga from thedailycoast.com and co-author of the brand new book, Crashing the Gate. Line 3 on the cell phone, you're on the air.
Perhaps a more mundane question. Your initial printing was supposed to be 25,000, the pre-printing of the book. Did that sell out? How close to 25,000 did you pre-sell? And how's it doing on the literally, how far up on the charts is it? I haven't seen anything mentioned on the site.
There are currently 80,000 copies of the book in print, and we have a small publisher, independent publisher, and so they did small first runs because they couldn't take a big risk as, say, you know, a big corporate publisher. But the demand has been high, so they've literally had 3 print runs already, and they're up to 80,000 books. How many have sold? You know, I have no idea.
Well, after today's show, I think you'll clear out the stomach.
The publishing industry is so archaic. It's so frustrating to somebody like me who's used to publishing at the push of a button, and suddenly you have this world where I turn in a manuscript and it doesn't go to print for 4 months afterwards. And that was fast. This was actually a rush job in the publishing industry. Usually it takes over a year from manuscript to actual final book. So I have no idea how many it sold. It's definitely climbing up in the Amazon rankings, and it's in the it's been up to the low hundreds and under 100. And the bestseller lists are several weeks behind, so we're hoping that next week it hits the bestseller list, like the New York Times bestseller list. But the book has been getting absolutely phenomenal reviews. I mean, we still don't have a negative review from a major publisher or a major reviewer. The New York Review of Books has us on a cover. This latest edition, we got a positive review from Peter Beinart in the New York Times. And Peter Beinart is the former editor of the New Republic, a fairly, calls himself a centrist Democrat. A year ago, he called for the ouster of me and people like me from the Democratic Party. So a year later, he reviews our books and gives it a thumbs up. So the response has been absolutely phenomenal in ways that I never expected and Jerome never expected. So we're at the start, and we won't know real sales numbers, I guess, for a while. But
sounds like you're doing well, Marcos Mulitzes. And I can tell you right now, if the phone calls are any indication, I think the book's going to be flying off the shelves because we have a full bank of calls, and every time a line opens, it fills instantly. And so we try to get to all these calls in our remaining 8 or 9 minutes. So I ask the callers to be as brief as possible. Line 4, LaSalle, Illinois, you're on the air with Marcos Mulitzes from thedailycoast.com.
Thank you so much. I'm an 80-year-old staunch Democrat. I love the Democratic Party. And I agree with you as far as Lieberman's concerned, and I love Feingold, and I think we should really push him. He's one of the few Democrats that will stand up and say something. But the thing I'm really worried about is the way the Democratic Party is pushing illegal immigration, because the blacks are upset by it a lot. Many of those blacks who need those jobs, They will take them, and you're keeping wages low. Another thing I'm so worried about, they're so brazen in those marches. When you consider what happened in France about 6 months ago, I think it was, where they were rioting. You know who was rioting? Illegals, aliens that were in there they gave citizenship to have cheap labor. Well, then after they're here a few years, they're going to rebel, and you're going to have a lot in your hands that they want to get more money. They're also costing us, as far as what it costs to give them all this money, you know, for medical help and schooling, et cetera. And to me, we're going to hurt our party.
Well, caller, we're running short on time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I want to give Marcos an opportunity to give his assessment of immigration and where it fits into Democratic politics.
Immigration's a really it's become fascinating because it actually has become a wedge for the Republicans. They have wedged themselves on the issue. There are people, there are Republicans that stand with Democrats and realize that these immigrants are hardworking. They come here to work. They have families. They love this country. They value it. And there should be a way for those who really do good work in this country to have a citizen track. And I'm an immigrant, so you're not going to hear me bashing any immigrants. This is a nation built on immigration. We have the Statue of Liberty that symbolizes that. And I think we can't turn our back on the fact that we are this nation of immigrants. It's what makes us so rich culturally and economically as well. I mean, this is what our nation is founded on. And so I hope that these well-meaning Republicans and Democrats can find a way to come to a solution to this problem.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 1, Chicago, you're on there with Marcos Mulitzis from thedailycoast.com.
Hi there. It seems like most of the discussion that I've been hearing has been about politics and the Internet, and I was wondering if you might both discuss something about the politics of the Internet. It's my understanding that there has been, and this may have since been killed, but there might have been legislation that would restrict the free speech rights of bloggers, and probably also legislation that's actually going through the works now, that might eliminate the non-discrimination practices of Internet traffic, what's called network neutrality. Marcos, I was wondering if you could, if you A, know something about this, and B, if you could describe what the blogosphere has been doing about this, what people can do about it, and how this might impact websites like yours and other blog websites to come. Thanks.
Thank you very much, caller.
The efforts to restrict the free speech of bloggers has essentially, it's over for now. The FEC passed a series of regulations that protect my ability and the ability of every blogger to talk about politics without having to be regulated by the government. It was fantastic. The FEC had draft rules a year ago that were dramatically different, but they listened to our concerns. I testified before the FEC in D.C., and they were incredibly responsive, and we couldn't be happier with the results. Now, there are groups who still want to fight this and will try to fight this, so we're going to have to be vigilant. For the moment, that's not an issue.
Marcos, actually, the net neutrality issue?
Yeah. Now, the net neutrality issue is actually ongoing. And the blogosphere is starting to gear up to fight this and to find out ways to lobby Congress to protect the ability for every net user to be able to access every site without penalty.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And next week's guest here on Media Matters will be Lawrence Lessig from Stanford Law School, who is an expert on net neutrality and Internet policy issues and how they would affect sites like thedailycoast.com, which would, in fact, be severely damaged if network neutrality is abandoned, or conceivably, and certainly all bloggers would be. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Marcos Mulitzis, author of Crashing the Gate.
Hi, I just wanted to comment on, you were talking about the censure proposal and not a lot of Democrats standing up and supporting that. You know, I would argue that, like I saw an article in the New York Times a couple weeks ago that took the censure proposal and really spun it in like a way that said, well, this is exactly what the Republicans want. They want, you know, the Democrats to get all upset about this and blah, blah, blah. I don't know if you saw that article, but it just seems like every time the Democrats do stand up and try to do something, that the media just, like, spins it to this, in my opinion, right-wing thing. I don't know. I don't know if that's very articulate, but it just seems like the media just takes something that I think is positive and really turns it around into some, you know, this is, you know, what the Republicans want. This is a gift, blah, blah, blah. If you could just comment on that. Thanks.
Yeah, and Marcos, yeah, I'm sure you saw the above the fold New York Times front page piece a couple of weeks ago she was referring to, where the New York Times sort of said conclusively that Republicans really want the Democrats to make an issue out of censure because that will galvanize the Republican base, implying that the smart move for the Democrats would be to maintain the Pelosi approach of basically taking no position, letting the Republicans sort of do whatever they want.
Every time Republicans give Democrats advice and stories like that, we should do the opposite. They don't have our best interests at heart. Obviously, they don't. So it's ridiculous. Now, I spend as little time as I can in D.C. because it is that kind of place. I mean, this is the kind of chatter that happens in those cocktail party circuits, and that's why Democrats in D.C. are so paralyzed, because some writer says, oh, well, if you stand up for something and you stand up for a principle, Republicans are going to win. And it paralyzes them, and it's mind-boggling that that happens. And that's why Democrats out in the states are actually winning in ways that Democrats in D.C. are not.
Let's go back to the phone lines for our final caller in this show today. Lion 3, Chicago, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a problem. You mentioned the your guest's name, but you seem to mumble his last name. Can you spell his last name, please, slowly, so I can copy it down?
I'd be glad to, and unfortunately, I probably mispronounced it, too. Marcos, how do you pronounce your name?
No, you pronounce it properly, Moulitsis. It's M-O-U.
Wait a minute. start spelling it again.
Okay. M-O-U.
Wait, M-O.
U.
Yeah.
L-I.
What's that? M-O-U. What's the next letter?
L as in Lima.
Okay.
I as in India.
Yeah.
T as in Tango.
You know what? I'm going to let you take this off air with our producer. Who'll pick up the phone now. As much as I appreciate the spelling bee, I don't think our listening audience is so tuned up for that. Marcus, we've only got about a minute and a half or so left, and I do want to touch on a couple of just let you have a chance to talk about what you think the key political races for Congress will be this fall that concerned citizens who share your interests in politics should be looking at and following closely, the ones that you'll be covering a lot on the DailyCoast.com website.
Well, in the Senate, which is obviously a big battleground, we have contests in Ohio, in Missouri, in Montana, believe it or not. It's trending Democratic. And in Rhode Island, and Arizona, and Nevada. Those are the key battlegrounds, Tennessee as well. Those states will determine whether we have a Democratic Senate or not. As far as the House, there are a good 30 to 40 House seats that are going to be in play, given how poorly Republicans are doing. And we actually have a better chance of picking up the House. We need to pick up 15 seats in the House. And the key here is not to focus on the Democrats that may not be perfect and those that are. The key is that if we win back control of either chamber of Congress, we will have subpoena power, and we can start holding this administration accountable for everything it has done.
On that note, I want to thank you so much, Marcos Moulitsis Zuniga, author of Crashing the Gate, along with Jerome Armstrong, founder of DailyCoast.com, for being our guest today on Media Matters. Thank you again for joining us, and we'll stay in touch with you. I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer, and I want to thank Dak Kral for coming in today, sitting in, doing the engineering. And my name is Bob McChesney. I'll be back in 167 hours with Dr. Larry Lessig.